When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
That cold case you're listening to? Nasty stuff. But you know what else is a crime? Missing even a moment of whatever you're doing to go on a drink run. Luckily, there's Drizly, the number one app for alcohol delivery. With Drizly, you can compare prices on the biggest selection of beer, wine, and spirits, then get them delivered in under 60 minutes. So download the Drizly app or go to drizly.com. That's DRIZLY.com today.
Featuring Hide Your Heart and a new smash single, Forever.
Well, we had 15 songs that we thought were great. And with this album, we really wanted to get back to our roots in the sense that over 15 years or whatever, you kind of start to collect excess baggage. If you're going on a long voyage, you know, your luggage gets full and you add another piece of luggage. Sooner or later, you look and you go, you know, there's a lot of stuff here we don't need. And we figured, let's go into the studio. Let's cut this album in a demo studio. Let's go somewhere where nobody's going to be telling us, oh, you're the greatest, while they're getting paid to tell you that you're the greatest. And no receptionist, nobody doing anything for us doing everything ourselves. Let's go in and make a balls-to-the-wall guitar rock and roll album, the same kind of stuff that we started out doing, the same kind of stuff we want to continue doing.
Is this going to be a show that's going to attract both your new fans and your old fans?
I think everybody's going to want to see this. It's spectacle. I mean, it's everything that Kiss has always been known for. Other bands can go out with the same kind of show, but none of them can be Kiss, and we just figured we'd go out and do the thing the way it's supposed to be done.
You're listening to the Cobras and Fire podcast. This week we break the record, the 1989 Kiss album, Hot in the Shade.
Cobras and Fire. I'm your host, LC, and I am joined, as always, with the hot mess, Baco. How are you, sir?
I am a hot mess in the shade of my basement. I don't know. We got the video, so you can kind of see my hair is getting a little bit too long. I can't wait for barbershops to reopen. Let's put it that way. And I'm sure the rest of the country feels that way, too.
Understood. Yes. I actually went to the Clippers, and it's a little too tight right now.
Your lettuce is too tight.
Hence the throw on the hat. But today, I think it's time to time travel and get away from the time of face masks and go back to a time when Kiss was unmasked, and that is 1989. What do you think of that transition? Is that cheesy enough?
Yeah, that's pretty cheesy. I like it.
Okay, cool.
All right, so today we're doing a concept we've been tossing around for a couple years. We're going to take the bloated mess of Hot in the Shade and strip it down to a perfectly sequenced, smooth, tight 10-track album. You have your 10, and I have my 10, and as we go through, we're going to kind of expose what each other has, right?
Pretty much. I mean, I think that, and we're also renaming the album Hotter Than Shade. Yes?
No. That was not discussed.
Hot Throwing Shade? Hotter in the Shade?
How about just Throwing Shade?
Throwing Shade. Yeah. I like it. Let's do that.
There we go. So, yeah, this is Hot in the Shade Redux, Throwing Shade.
Okay. A diamond really is just a piece of coal. But once you shape it and everything, it turns into a glorious something that's priceless. And that's what we're going to do today.
You got to squish it down.
There's a lot. You got to make it tighter.
Less.
You have to polish it, things like that. And exactly. Diamonds, they're not huge. There's just enough, and they're beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I think that this is an unpolished diamond, this album, where I think it gets a lot of shit. And I think through going through this today, you're going to find that there are some well-written songs on here. And it may be because of the fact that they put as much time into the actual production of the album. They actually leveled it. And I think they threw a couple overdubs on there, just like we do every episode.
Mm-hmm.
That maybe that is part of the problem too. But we're going to get into all of that. But yes, at the end of this, you're going to have two perfectly sequenced albums, an album that stands in the Kiss catalog.
I'm okay with the album as it is. I really don't need to strip it down. I will say, as someone who enjoys listening to something as an album, it does need that. It does need that kind of more tighter beginning, ending. When I listen to this, it's a lot like listening to like smashes and thrashes and hits. It just kind of drones on. But as far as the material on here, there really isn't anything that I, other than maybe Read My Body, but we'll get into all that.
Not for me.
But, you know, whatever. For the sake of podcasting and also, you know, I do think it is an improvement. I listened to my retracking three times yesterday, and spot on, it's perfect.
Yeah, and I do think if you're a fan of this concept, then because we like to promote ourselves, go check out Purge Your Illusion, and also check out the Purge of 1978, where we take all the Kiss albums and the solo albums and make one awesome, incredible album as well.
So, correct.
But you have a little more pain with this process than I do. I enjoy it. I love the Purge.
Well, you know, because, you know, in the back of my mind, it's like I'm getting rid of this forever, and it's just going to be a shitty fucking demo in the Gene Simmons vault. Well, let's get into some of the details of the album. Is that all right?
Absolutely. Let's go.
It was released October 17th, 1989. It was recorded at some dump that nobody uses called The Fortress in Hollywood, California. It comes in at a fairly brisk 58 minutes and 39 seconds when you consider there's 15 fucking songs on here.
Sure.
And unfortunately produced by Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley. Released on Mercury Records locally here. I think, what is Vertigo, the rest of the world? Something like that. I don't know. Had three music videos, Rise to It. In order it went, Hide Your Heart, Forever, and Rise to It, if I recall.
Yep. And, of course, the Rise to It video, particularly notable for Gene and Paul shoving their bodies into their 1970s outfits of different eras and having, I don't know, maybe a guy that was the grip on there pretend he was playing drumsticks or something like that, right?
Oh, right, yeah. All right, so it peaked in the U.S. at number 29, respectable for the time, definitely. It went gold in the United States and platinum in Canada, which is 100,000 units in Canada, which means every Canadian citizen bought this record. So as far as charting on the Billboard Hot 100, Hide Your Heart peaked at number 66. Forever peaked at number 8, their first top 10 single since, I Was Made for Loving You. And Rise to It just was a scorcher, tearing its way to number 81. So, yeah. Kiss never really a charting band, though. I mean,
well, yeah, but that, and quick comment on that. I find that pretty surprising that it only went gold when it had their biggest single. You know, my math says that it should have gone platinum because
the research, you know what I mean? I did, I couldn't find an official number, but in the Eric Carr book, I think Larry Mazur said it just was right around 900,000 is where it left off.
Okay, so it was close,
yeah.
Gotcha.
But, you know, still got Canadian platinum, eh?
Sure.
Well, what did you think of the album cover?
Well, there's two things that Kiss actually did that was innovative, and not that many bands were doing the whole 60-minute max out the CD length at this point. That came more in the 90s.
Mm.
So that was innovative, and the fact that they were the first rock band to use what didn't even exist yet either, which is the cool emoji on the cover, which, you know, a dude with sunglasses, this time Leon Sphinx. Not a fan. Also not believable that a Sphinx could hold sunglasses because it doesn't have a nose.
Right.
What are your thoughts on it?
You know, it's okay. I have to admit it didn't really stick out when I saw it in the record store because the first thing that stands out to me about it is that it, like, you can barely make out the Kiss logo because it's done like a little postage stamp. It's not their finest hour as far as that, but I don't know. I kind of like it. It works with the title and stuff of that nature. You like the idea of maybe just using that back photo?
Yeah, I mean, maybe a better version of it or something like that. But, you know, because it kind of showed the band more worn, let's just call it street clothes, or more closer to the Revenge type look, where it kind of, to me, it symbolizes more the sound of the album, too, because it's more back to basics a little bit.
I think so, but except for there, I mean, you got Eric Carr dressed like he's just off the set of Miami Vice playing a drug dealer.
I get it.
Paul was really starting to embrace the vest. That might have been the inspiration for me around this time.
Ooh,
and,
I see.
I don't know. The Bruce never looked good, no matter how he dressed. So he always kind of looked kind of like a nerd. Tucked his shirt in too much.
He was listening to a lot of Queensryche at the time, you got to realize.
I'm a fan of not having band photos on the front. I think, I don't know, never. I mean, sometimes it works really good. I mean, it's their classic covers of the 70s, you know, they're all on there, and it's usually some really cool artwork and stuff of that nature. But, like, I don't care for the Dynasty cover that much. Lick It Up is pretty lame.
What about Monster, though? That's a good one, though.
Yeah, Monster. Yeah, to me, that's kind of what this back photo looks like. Monster, that should have been the back album cover. Putting it on the front makes it look like one of those fake albums that you get at truck stops. You know what I mean? It would be like, you know, April Wine's The Best Of, and it's just some cheap fucking looking thing. That's what Monster looks like. And they use the Monster Energy Drink logo.
What if the album cover was that photo, but it's just them standing in front of the Sphinx?
Yeah, now we're talking.
Well, come on. That's what the tour was. Here's my question about the cover. One more thing, though. Do you think that the idea of putting a goddamn Sphinx on a stage came after the album came out or before?
After.
Me too.
I can confirm it, actually.
Oh, you can. Okay. Yeah. All right. Fair enough. Yeah, we have to validate why we put a Sphinx with sunglasses on. And how come no sunglasses on the tour?
They did have them.
Oh, they did.
One of the things that I bought that I've lost over the years that I really wish I would have at least bought a second pair, because it was only $5. Mm. I bought a pair of Kiss Hot in the Shade sunglasses. Somewhere along the line, I lost them. Part of the reason was they were my everyday sunglasses from that point on. But anyway.
Those are your everyday. Which one are you going to wear?
Well, they were. Well, you know what I mean. It's just like.
Does it have the actual the logo on the sunglasses?
No, they were basically those Blues Brothers style glasses with just a little tiny Kiss logo on the side. So it was nice and subtle.
Subtle. I would have expected the K and the I being on one lens. And the
yeah,
S
if they did
the
it now, there. They'd be fucking full print over to lens and everything.
That's what I mean. Okay, subtlety.
One last kind of note of that I think is going to set up a lot what we talk about. Larry Mazur came in right after the record was done to become Kiss's new manager. I have a bunch of comments from Larry kind of that apply to things that are going on at this time. Kind of interesting stuff, so.
Sure, but it was an interesting move to do a 15-song album in general and to...
Yeah, 15 was a lot, but you're really think about the albums that came out around this time. I mean, Hysteria was before this. That was 12 tracks.
True.
Tesla was 12. It was really it was starting to become common leading up to this to max out, you know, your cassettes and CD. Now they, you know, this kind of pushed it, you know, like I said, 15. I don't think anybody was going over 13.
Well, we had 15 songs that we thought were great.
And in general, with Kiss, even on their best efforts for the most part, there's always a couple stinkers, in my opinion, on an album, for the most part. Mm-hmm. So when you get 15, you know, math would serve that half of these would be stinkers. And I think that's the general consensus from the Kiss fandom.
Let's tear the Band-Aid off this sucker and see what we got here. Like I said, we're going to start off with side one. We're going to do a side A and side B thing here. 5 songs on each side. We've both resequenced it. For those listening, that means we basically shuffled the songs around in the order we think makes sense. At least
sequencing does matter, Pooney.
Yeah, it really does. I'm surprised you feel that way, considering you basically live your life as a playlist. You know, just put it on random, right?
Yes, but all my playlists are sequenced.
Okay. All right, fair enough. Well, what did you have? What's opening the loose cannon version of A Hot in the Shade?
For me, when I sequence this, I'm not sequencing this just to be cute and be, man, if I just, this would blow people's mind by opening this album with this one. What is the best opening song? And one thing that no matter what complaints you have on certain Kiss albums, very few times do they pick the wrong opening track.
Correct.
You could argue against. And this album is no different. So I'm opening it up with Rise to It.
Hmm. That's an interesting choice.
Yeah, sure, yeah. But no, there's nothing that needs to be changed here. The one thing I always thought was a bit odd was, and I'm not sure, again, and that I'm going to throw it to you as a guitarist, the choice to open the, is it steel guitar, slide guitar? What do you consider it?
It's slide, but it does say what he played. It just says slide, but yeah, to me that's a just kind of like it's an acoustic guitar that he's playing. But
okay, but to me it really reminded me of what came out a year earlier. For whatever reason, it reminded me of Bad Seamstress Blues by Cinderella is the first thing it was, and it doesn't really connect to the rest of the song. It is cool, but it's definitely unique and everything like that too for the whole Kiss canon or whatever to start off that way.
Right.
And it just starts with that sliding bass and then boom and goes into pretty much a song that could be about motivating yourself to keep going and run the extra mile or getting a raging boner, whatever. You know, it goes both ways. I dig it. Your thoughts?
Well, I also tend to agree that Kiss has done a pretty good job in sequencing their records. I think, honestly, I probably wouldn't do much with this album if we weren't taking songs out. But once, you know, we took five tracks out, you kind of got to refigure how the album's going to begin and end. I do think it matters. I think album sequencing is very big part of the how much pleasure you get out of listening to something. You kind of know what's coming next. It has a flow to it. I, too, picked Rise to It. It is the out of the songs that we're selecting with, at least, you know, because it made the cut. It's a great opener. It's an uplifting song about being able to get a boner at the appropriate time.
Sure.
But not at the inappropriate time is kind of the message I took away from it. But, yeah, you know, I could live without the slide thing. I think that just actually helps it work as an opener, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But yeah, the song kicks in, and they didn't do that on tour, did they?
No idea. I don't think so.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if they even played Rise to It the whole tour, did they?
I definitely saw them play it, but and they don't change their set list up.
Just to know if it got dropped.
But yeah, so right out of the gate, we both got Rise to It as the opening track, so nothing changes there.
I just love the fact that it's an opening track, and it actually has Paul saying, "Listen!
Listen!
This is not just green light. What is it? Red light. Don't say no. She says stop, baby. Go, go, go. He's actually breaking. He's breaking this woman's will by the second verse on this. But I love the part that I love the most about this song is the fact that it takes that get up, lights, camera, action part. That bridge.
Yeah,
it takes
the next level. Kick ass right after the solo.
Hey!
I really like that. It's got a great solo by Bruce. But the thing that's interesting about this is that with prepping for this episode is Bob, an un-rock name, but Bob Halligan Jr. is one of the songwriters on this. And they use a big variety of songwriters in this, I think more than the normal. But to tell you more about Bob Halligan Jr., I am going to turn it over to professional Wikipedia reader Chris Sinzak of Decibel Geek.
As a songwriter, Halligan has contributed songs to two albums by heavy metal band Judas Priest, Take These Chains from 1982's Screaming for Vengeance, and the single Some Heads Are Gonna Roll from 1984's Defenders of the Faith. Halligan also worked extensively with the hard rock heavy metal band Kix beginning in the mid-1980s, when he co-wrote most of the songs on the band's third album, Midnight Dynamite. Incidentally, one of the most successful songs he has ever written is Kix's near top 10 hit Don't Close Your Eyes, and my favorite Kiss song ever, Read My Body. God damn it.
Yeah, just interesting. He writes two songs on this album. One we'll get to later. But yeah, so Bob Halligan Jr., only time they've ever worked with him was this album.
I wonder if that means these songs might have been skeletal, or like they took a song he wrote and then just kind of reworked it for themselves, and then they gave him songwriting credit or something. I don't know. The fact that he doesn't really pop up anywhere kind of leads me to think that they didn't actually work together. But I honestly, speculating. You know what I mean?
It's interesting. But his kind of songwriting credits are only in this little pocket of like 5 years during the 80s for bands.
Yeah. Just not a household name. He's not Desmond Child, you know what I mean? Or Holly Knight or Diane Warren. He's not even a Jean Bouvert.
That's right. Well done with a pronunciation, by the way.
Thank you.
It wasn't until podcasts I could even say his name.
It's probably Bouvier.
Oh, probably.
But thanks to Kiss fans everywhere, it's now Bouvier.
So out the gate, we got the same opening track, but track two, Rise to It, rings out, and it leads into what track, Bucko?
I took Prisoner of Love and slid it up into the number two spot. It's a Gene song, co-wrote with Bruce Kulick. And clocks in at 3:52 if you're counting at home. I've always kind of dug this tune, and I like the way the... He just doesn't have a lot of style, and he's a really solid guitar player. But you know, when you think about the great players of the 80s, you know, George Lynch, Jakey Lee, Eddie Van Halen, even like the guy from Rat, Demartini, they all have a very distinct sound that when you hear them, they sound like them. And Bruce Kulick just sounds different every damn record, and it kind of sounds, I don't know, a little plasticky to me. Don't get me wrong, he's an amazing fucking player. He can do almost anything, but a lot of guys that are like that, they just, you know, there's a reason that he was able to go from Meatloaf to Michael Bolton to Kiss without a hitch.
How dare you?
Anyway, back to the song here. Apparently, Bruce had the skeleton of this thing. It was going to actually open up more like Domino, where he's plucking the strings, you know. And Gene decided to turn it into a shuffle. I love it, but Bruce apparently doesn't really care for that change. And as we get along here, we're going to find out Bruce doesn't care for this record that much. I don't know if you had the same song at number two. If not, what are your thoughts? And then we'll get into what your number two was.
Yeah, no, I don't have Prisoner of Love as number two, but this song, not that it sounds just like it, but kind of the chord progression or main riff or whatever kind of gives me a kind of a Cold Gin vibe.
Okay.
That kind of just like that, the way it's played. And this one actually, when you said about Bruce, I do agree about, you know, he basically did what he was told as far as the tone. I do think there is some maybe uniformity between this and Revenge as far as like maybe his own sound a little bit. But with that said, the guitar solo on this is one of my favorite by him on this album, where it just rips. And if it didn't have that in it, I'm not sure that I would like it the song as a whole as much. But yeah, this is a great just straight up rocker. And I have to say, that's not my number two, but that is a pretty solid position. That was one of my places for number two.
Okay. What did you have at number two?
Yeah, man. At this point, still, I haven't changed anything. I think it's good as is. And that is, we go right into Betrayed, which, my God, this is basically 1989 Deuce. It is just straight on, you know, it is the drums, just the relentless riff going through the whole thing. We've got a great solo, you know, Gene drops an F-bomb. You pay your taxes. You pay the rent till you haven't got a cent. Why has TurboTax not picked this up? It's like a song that they play on their commercials.
And it continues the tradition of Gene just kind of using like bumper sticker catchphrases as lyrics. You know, it's a law of the jungle. If you got the hunger, what doesn't kill you will make you stronger.
Hey. Love it. You see a rising star with the songwriter of Tommy Thayer being a co-writer.
Gene used to pick Paul up at the therapist office, and he would just look at the signs on the wall and then take him home and write music with lyrics.
You know what? Somehow these bumper stickers all blend into some just a glorious song for me. You got your backs against the wall. Yeah. Nobody gives a fuck. I wish this song, I think if this song, and this goes to a lot of the songs on this album, was produced better, they would be loved more. But I just think this song is the first attitude I've heard from Gene from probably since Lick It Up. That kind of just like fuck you. I love the vibe of the song. It's my number two. It's a great 1-2 punch. What say you, Baco?
Well, it was co-written by Tommy Thayer, who at the time was working as Gene and Paul's groundskeeper.
Of course.
But yeah, he took a little break from the sun, kind of. Wiped off the brow, came in and co-wrote this pile of shit. Yeah, this song didn't even make my 10, so this is just, I don't know, a steaming heap of meh. This is a quick skip on the CD player, man. It's just nothing. I can't believe you fucking compared this to Deuce. Honest to God.
It's got the same vibe. Same vibe. I'm not saying it's Deuce.
It's got that drum beat, but it has no vibe. I mean, if anything, this song lacks vibe. Now, getting to the production, though, you've definitely heard that some of these songs are actually, just worked up demos.
Yep.
That they recorded with a drum machine. Have you ever found out specifically which tracks? Because in prepping for this, all I could find is that they didn't actually use a regular drum kit for the songs they did play drums on. They used like a synth kit, those pads. Right. And I love the explanation. I found it in two different places because the studio didn't have a drum set. Well, does Eric have one?
I don't get that either. And I don't get the whole synth thing. Like I hear it in...
Hello, Pantheon Podcast listeners. Christian Swain here to tell you more about my experience with Raycon earbuds. Our family now has 3 pairs of Raycon earbuds around the house. And my wife just grabbed a pair of the Headphone Pros to replace some headphones from a company that was double the price. And yes, she loves them. Now, if you haven't pulled the trigger on a pair of Raycons, or even if you have, but you're in the market for another pair because they're just that good, well, now is the time to check them out. Because they just launched their upgraded model of the best-selling everyday earbuds. With Raycon's upgraded everyday earbuds, now you also get active noise cancellation, ergonomic design, and multi-point connectivity that lets you pair with 2 devices at once. New quick charge function, 3 customizable sound styles, plus awareness mode. Available in a variety of vibrant new colors to complement any and all skin tones. I even have a pair of earbuds in a cool green color. I have tried just about every earbud known to humankind, and these Raycons are fantastic. Seriously, if you've been wanting to check out Raycons, there truly is no better time. You're going to ask yourself why you didn't check them out sooner, and Raycon offers a 30-day happiness guarantee. So, what are you waiting for? Go to buyraycon.com/pantheon today to get 20% off your Raycon order, plus free shipping. That's right, you'll get 20% off and free shipping at buyraycon.com/pantheon. buyraycon.com/pantheon.
I think Love's a Slap in the Face is definitely a...
That's the only one that I could find. That
maybe Read My Body is. I'm not sure.
Yeah, but that one definitely sounds like it.
Definitely sounds like it. But how can it just be like the synth thing for a lot of the other songs? I don't hear that. Until Julian Gill comes out with a Hot in the Shade book, I'm not going to completely believe all those things. About
late summer, I'm hearing.
Oh, really? Good. Excellent.
How has he not already done it?
That's true.
Oh, man. But, Back to Betrayed, that's I got cut from mine, so.
Wow. I think it's just your hate of Tommy Thayer. You didn't like it then.
has another co-wrote that might be one of my favorite songs on the record. So, suck
that's a little
loose.
Spoiler for you.
Well, that brings us to track three on side one. What did you have here, man? Can I guess?
You can ask. Well, you know what? I'll actually answer your question with a question, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Do you know why the King of Hearts has to hide his heart?
Why?
Because he has a heart of chrome. Eat your heart up, baby. There's a lot of heart.
I can't believe I laughed at that. I just lost a bunch of credibility with people.
It's all right. The answer to your question is hide your heart. Again, Lazy Man hasn't changed a thing, but also it's the 1-2-3 punch. I think that Kiss is great with their third song in position a lot of times, too.
Yeah.
I could go into a whole thing about track threes on albums, too. But I think it's a perfect track three and probably my second favorite song on the album overall. I think it's a great song. And also, co-writers in this song, some facts. You've got Desmond Child, Paul, and Holly Knight. And if you want to hear more information about how this song was written, check out the Hustle podcast with John Lambrow. Great interview with her there, as well as Rock Solid with Pat Francis. Desmond, according to Holly Knight, Desmond and Paul like conference called her back in the day.
Yeah.
Or they're at the studio and they're like, hey, you know, is it okay? Do you want songwriting credit on this or something like that? Because they had redone something on it, but it was basically per her. She had written the song almost completely. And I'm going to hand it over to you because you probably know Fox about this. This song mystified me before we even get into the Kiss version of what happened to it and how many artists cover it and the fact that it was an Aces album. Can you explain a little bit of that? Because I'm still a bit confused on how all these versions came out at the same time.
These songs are kind of like submitted for people to work on. You know, when a band gets together to do a record, a lot of times they actually take in, you know, I mean, I if you recall, Bryn from Flip talked about submitting a song to Kiss called Freak.
Right.
So there are all these songwriters out there that are looking for people to pick up a track or something like that. So, yeah, how Ace, of all people, ended up doing, that's kind of the weird thing to me. It's almost like they found out Ace did it, so they did it too. That's how it feels, you know what I mean? Because, you know, how fucking...
Who came out first, though? Those albums
Ace was
almost...
just a little first, earlier, I think.
Really?
Wait, no. Okay. No, Ace was just shortly after, I think.
That's what I thought, okay.
But yeah, they both came out, you know, in fall of 89. But yeah, how Molly Hatchet and who are the other ones? Robin
Beck. Bonnie Tyler?
Yeah.
Too?
And if you go back and listen to my interview with Craig Smith, I do a mashup of all the versions.
Yeah.
That's why I figured you knew more about it.
Yep. But yeah, it is weird. You know what other song that had that happen a lot was that song Back on the Streets, the Vinnie Vincent song. A lot of people covered that, including Ace. And I'm like, I don't care for the song that much, but that's not really the point. It does seem odd that so many people, especially in the same amount of time.
That's what I mean. Like, I can't think of another song out there in history that everybody came out with their version. Like, they were trying to run a race to put it out all at the same time. And oddly, and I think it's a fantastic song.
Yep.
But oddly, none of them really did that well. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think that charted overall. I think Kisses probably was the highest charting version of all of them.
Yeah, I would say theirs is the best, too.
Yeah, I do, too. I don't think it works with Ace or anything like that. But
Ace's is the worst one.
Yeah, I think No. Your thoughts on the song?
Well, I also had it coming in the third slot. I left it right where it was. Perfect place. According to Desmond Child, the song was actually originally called Bite Down Hard. So I'm like, you gotta bite down hard. Dun, dun, dun.
Okay.
I absolutely love this song. I think it might be my, I don't know, it's definitely my top two or three as far as tracks on here. I do think it's, I don't know, you always like the story songs. So this is, you know, tells a story of, you know, a girl cheating on her boyfriend who happens to have violent tendencies. And doesn't somebody end up dying in the end?
Well, I'm not sure if you know, this is actually the prequel to Detroit Rock City. Then he got drunk and crashed in the car on the way to a concert.
Oh, I thought it was more of a modern day Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, it absolutely is. Sure. Yeah. Okay.
But I like your version, too. Anyway, so sure. that gets us up to track three on side one.
I have to say that when I first heard this on the radio, there was something that it goes through this whole album is there's something about the guitar tone. I'm just going to call it flat or something like that about this album. That's just, it doesn't sound like any Kiss album before it or after. And it's kind of this, is that maybe because of the demo quality or
something in that area? It is just the production. It's just not EQ'd very sharp. I actually would say the guitar tone on Asylum is somewhat similar in that comparison.
You're right. So. I have to agree about that. Actually, it's that kind of just like maybe just not bait. Just mixed, like it's thin. Is that a better word? Thin?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, it's okay. Got a lot of modulation on it. I don't know. It doesn't feel like it's really EQ'd very good. But you know, that's kind of a dummy's version of it. I'm sure the studio had the capability of making it sharper sounding based on what the record sounds like, the drums and everything. But maybe they just had shitty mics.
Actually, I think it's because. The studio didn't have guitars there. And those were the only guitars they could use.
Yeah, this is all recorded on Keytar.
That's right. That's the problem. We have Keytars and we have fake drum kits. That's all we got at this place, the Fortress. That's all we could afford was Keytars and fake drum kits.
And there's literally no solution to change either one of those.
Well, this is what we got. We can't bring our own stuff in.
I really hope that's true, though, that like, well, we can't use real drums because they don't have them here. Like, well, go get them. Nope.
It won't. See, it's against the union. Won't allow it.
The doors are really skinny. You
can't. That's right.
You maybe get a piccolo snare and a couple cymbals through. That's about it. I mean, yeah, Gene has to record in the parking lot. He's too fat to fit through the doors.
All right, man. So we both have Hide Your Heart in position number three. What do you have as your fourth track, Baco?
I have the monster ballad Forever coming up to the coveted number four spot. Just, you know, that way get all your singles on side one. That makes, you know, Michael Wagner happy. It's just kind of a nice spot for it. You know what I mean? It's just a little break and, you know.
I gotta tell you what I'm feeling inside.
I could lie to myself, but it's true. There's no denying when I look in your eyes. Girl, I'm out of my head over you. And I lived so long believing all of this lies. But everything about you is telling me this time it's forever.
the song. I think as far as a ballad goes anyway, this is one of their better ones, obviously. I think I like Every Time I Look at You a little bit better than this, just as a kind of a comparison close to this. But this is better than Reason to Live. And yeah, I'm a little surprised that this didn't push more copies of the record, because it was a huge hit. And I really like this video, too. I think all the videos on this for this record are pretty cool. But this one, I kind of like that kind of black and white with splashes of color on it. And in the video, Eric Carr is playing a full drum set. Apparently, they didn't shoot it where they recorded it. But yeah, it's just kind of a laid back where they're just kind of sitting around on, I think Paul's standing, but Bruce and Gene are on stools. And I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just kind of a nice video for the time. It's well shot and edited, all that good stuff. This one, like I said, I think we touched on it at the beginning. This peaked at number 8, which is pretty good for Kiss. And, you know, typically I would go to a Kiss concert with Wilson and maybe one or two other guys. I went with 10 people to this concert, and it was largely because of this song, I think. I don't think I would have had that many friends interested, is what I mean.
No, I hear you. And I should say this is, you know, co-written by Michael Bolton, a little connection from Bruce Kulick's past in Blackjack, is kind of how the history is told. But this is one of the ballads from the 80s that I think stands up. I never had an issue with the song. As far as just a well-written ballad and great solo from Bruce being an acoustic too, which I thought was good, versus, you know, a lot of times back in the day you'd have this, you know, you'd have a power ballad and all of a sudden they would say, like, all right, we got to man it up here and just have this ripping, crazy-ass guitar solo in the middle of, like, an acoustic-type ballad. So I did like that part of it, too. But this goes to the whole thing also where, why do you shy away from the hits? I never understand this. This should have, I don't think, ever really left their set list. And you know what I mean? Because it was what I mean by that is that if they're talking about for the casual fans, and we've debated this back and forth, then why do you not play one of your top 10 hits? I get the fact that, yeah, it probably looks goofy with the makeup, but even before that, it was just kind of like, they just kind of like dropped it. So
I don't want to hear it's Paul just a mystery. Sing this now.
I get that. Well, you don't want to hit Paul to sing anything right now for the most part.
Right.
But I'm just saying in general, I just think it's funny how they shy away from their
I get what your point is. I think when they put the makeup back on, And I can tell you there's other people like Larry Mazur who agree with me. That is basically you're resetting and things are – that's what you do. Like, you know, when Black Sabbath brought Ozzy back, they weren't playing Dio hits. It's a little different because you still have the singers in the band. But to me, there's just something about the imagery of the makeup that makes those 80s songs – it's just difficult for me. It's just – I don't know. It's like uncomfortable when they play anything. But that's more of a personal thing. I think you at your point, if they're going to do it, which they do, I don't see why this is one that they're not getting, because it was a monster hit. You can even make that argument for Reason to Live, honestly.
Yeah. I mean, you know, what's less goofy is this versus Beth in the makeup. I get the fact that it's from different eras. I'm just saying that Beth is so goofy live and stuff like that.
I think Beth is stupid live, especially as an encore, but
yeah.
Paul had some interesting things to say about this song in his book.
Funny thing about Forever, because it was somewhat uncharacteristic for Kiss, people pegged it as a Michael Bolton song, since he was co-credited as songwriter. Surely I couldn't have written it. In fact, after an all-too-brief initial writing session at the Sunset Marquee, Michael had so little to do with it that once it became a hit, he asked the Kiss office to fax him over a copy of the lyrics. Only then did he start performing the song in concert and introducing it as a song he wrote for Kiss. When our record label first heard Forever, it was the first time in a decade that an A&R man at our label actually weighed in with an opinion on one of our songs. He sat me down in his office and said I needed to re-edit it so it faded out on the chorus. That was song arranging 101, and even though it could be effective in some cases, it wasn't right for that song. The ending was one of the qualities that made Forever unique. This desk expert pushed his opinion relentlessly and with a tone that made it seem like more of a directive than a suggestion. I'd had enough. I was doing this before you were in grade school, I told him. I was at this label before you were here, and I'll be here after you're gone. So thanks, but no thanks. That was the end of the meeting. Forever reached number 8 on the Billboard Singles Chart, giving us our first top 10 single in more than a decade. Not long after, that record company expert was replaced with the next one.
It's a solid, well-written song, but it did, I'm sure, take a lot of people, have them take a back step, like, whoa, who is this? You know, playing this kind of, you know, if you're a longtime Kiss fan.
Did you also have Forever at number 4? What do you got here?
My first side is a concept album. It's a concept album about the street. You're angry about your taxes after you've got a boner. You're hiding your heart. And you know what? The street giveth and the street taketh away, man.
Look out.
That's my number 4. You go right to Street, a Gene and a Paul Street song, man. And also, this is a Tommy Thayer heavy side. Second co-write by Tommy Thayer. And I've heard the knocks on this song here and there that it's like Suffragette City, you know, David Bowie and stuff like that. The Hey Man. Can you really brand a Hey Man? I mean, is that? I get there's a lot of similarity there, but this, I'll even say it right now. Here's a mind bomb. Better than Suffragette City. What do you think of that, people?
I've definitely listened to it more than Suffragette City, but I think I like Suffragette City a little bit better. I think...
Oh, Suffragette.
Yeah.
Whatever. See? That's another reason it's not... It's a better song. You pronounce it better.
Yeah, see, it is... Well, it's a bit of a tongue twister. The street giveth and the street taketh away. It's got S
was this the,
in it.
Was this... Yeah. Was this the B-side of Hide Your Heart? It was the B-side for one of the singles.
You know, I don't know. I don't have that in front of me.
I'm going with it.
Nobody
that
cares about that shit.
Well, I'm saying if it was the B-side, that's the whole thing. This is the Gene's version and Paul's version. There's a lot of synchronicity with some of their songwriting on this song. That's all I got to tell you. On this album, I mean.
I do think the Bowie thing was intentional. I believe Gene has actually said it as much. So, in other words, you know, it wasn't like he was trying to, you know, slip something past the people, you know what I mean? I think it was, maybe homage is too strong a term, but I think he deliberately and openly was like, yeah, I'm kind of lifting that little thing there. It's not worth a songwriting credit, but, you know, it is kind of a nod to it. This might be my favorite track on the record. It depends on the mood,
nice.
but I fucking love it. I've heard some people kind of shit on it, and I don't get it. This is just a killer fucking tune. And even that like little acoustic break in the middle where it goes... giant chorus just balls up right after that. It's just great. It's a fun tune. It rolls good. It stands up despite Tommy Thayer's involvement because, of course... I have to hate everything that he touches, right?
The chorus, infectious as hell. That goes through my head. But going back to the whole production thing one more time is a lot of the songs on Hot in the Shade are actually better written than Revenge. And going back to this, my point is the production can take away overall from your enjoyment of the album, of an album for people.
As much as I would, I'll concede this album probably could have used a producer. And it would have sounded better. I don't think the production of this thing is just total shit, though. I don't think the songs would have been drastically up or down on people's opinion if, like, Ezrin or Nevison or Michael James Jackson would have came in and done it. You know what I mean? I don't think it would have been that much of a stamp, to be honest with you.
I will counter that argument in saying that it's because it's too bloated. The production's not good, but I'll tell you what, for demos,
a producer
not
would
that
have
bad.
Stripped this fucker down to 10 tracks.
That's right. That's what we're doing right here.
And that's that would have been the biggest help.
All right. Listen. again, demos, not that bad.
I'll flat out say this, man, because to most people, if they weren't told they were demos, they wouldn't go, this sounds like a demo. I'm sorry. I've heard Kiss demos. This is a much fucking shinier package than the average demo that that is out there. So I think that because that's been out there so long, everybody feels like they're an expert on like, oh, well, yeah, these are just demos. Well, does Forever sound like a fucking demo to you? Does Hide Your Heart sound like a demo? Because there's a lot of shit going on in those songs.
Right. And that's what I think, too, is I think that some of them, that the production is, to my ears, a little different per song, too. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, like, they work separately. You know?
Well, I'm saying, like, as far as the effort they put forth on it, like, I think Forever does sound like a fully produced song versus it. I think they took more time on the singles as far as mixing and stuff.
Probably. Yeah, they knew which ones are going to be put out there. So,
right.
All right. With that, let's close out side one before we flip the cassette or turn the platter. By the way, can I say something on the vinyl on this one?
Oh, please.
First of all, the original issue of this. I mean, the volume is so fucking low because they had to squeeze these, you know, grooves together so tight to fit all fucking 15 tracks on one vinyl.
Right.
Well, they just recently reissued it. I think it was an orange one. You know, like, first of all those Kiss vinyl reissues, they're kind of cool, but do you have any fucking idea what you're doing? You're just like, hey, let's do this one. It's, hey, this one's turning 30. Let's do an orange fucking Hot in the Shade or whatever. You know what I mean? But again, you think, well, now you're going to do it, repress it on vinyl, do it right, put it on two fucking records. Nope. So
really,
yeah.
They still did that.
Yeah,
interesting.
Like, fucking A, man. I really wish somebody, because I know this is more of a Universal Music thing, and Gene and Paul are probably not involved, but maybe they should try to find a way to be involved. Because I think it'd be really cool if they went back and did some of these more deluxe kind of gatefold packages on some of these. Do this one on two pieces on two discs instead of, you know, one, to make it actually sound decent on vinyl. I digress. We're wrapping up side one. What do you got for the last track on side one?
The audiophile myself, in going the direction of vinyl, a lot of the sequencing back in the day used to be putting like a lighter song as the last song on the side because of the limits of the grooves, man. So I am selecting Forever. I think it's a nice play out song to side one, and also it's going to sound better in that position too on the vinyl. So I'm doing this for you. I'm doing this for you, Craig Smith. Just get ready to pick up that needle. It's not going to return to its home.
You motherfucker.
My fifth track was Love's a Slap in the Face. Embracing the cassette era, not worried about the vinyl grooves. I think in hindsight, Gene's music holds up a lot better than he gets, you know, like he gets ripped a lot of bit for basically checking out. But I think this is a killer tune. It holds up better than a lot of Paul stuff. I don't know, man. I love that. Nah, 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 nah. That's just kind of sleazy and it's just great.
Don't forget the nah, 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 nah.
I never thought it would hurt so good. No, no. Yeah. And an old friend comes back into the picture in Vinnie Poncia. Just a weird name to see in 1989, you know, for he produced Peter's record and then they brought him on to produce Dynasty and Unmasked, to kind of, I don't know, polarizing Kiss records. So the idea that they're working with Vinny again, kind of weird, but he gets a bunch of co-writes on here.
He does, yeah. Like, almost like the second half of the album, he starts blowing up with his name.
Right on.
Now, this is what I call, what I love, is when you get clean Gene.
I don't think Gene cared about my solo tour at all.
It's something about the vocal on here that just shows, yeah, I think it's very, maybe soulful, or there's something about, this was the part too that I realized that even if the songs weren't great, that I just love Gene and Paul's voice, like on anything for the most part. You know what I mean? How they harmonize, how they do that. Like you can the whole cliche about singing the phone book or whatever. I'm like, yes, it's different. Yes, there's a drum machine, which by the way also sounds better at the end on the vinyl record too when you have a drum machine.
Yes,
the last track for the grooves. But I do think that the song is also amusing because he doesn't commit. Is love a slap in the face or is it a ball and chain?
Well, it was originally titled Love's a Mushroom Stamp on the Forehead.
Okay. That's interesting. That's different from my notes from the original title.
Vinny changed it.
mine was actually Love's Chlamydia in June.
Okay.
Love's a lollipop. Love can be a lot of different things, man.
Jesus Chrysler says love is a lie.
Oh, see? Yeah. So it's this one is actually, this song could have just been called Debatable. For sequencing, it's an interesting song because where do you put it? You know what I mean?
Sure. Yeah. No, I've put it in the perfect spot, track five.
Okay. But with that, too, is that I do have to say is that the thing I do respect about this album, too, is the fact that it has a lot of different styles on it, which I think sometimes makes the average Kiss what's this called? Lunkhead. Their minds explode.
We know you're talking about Mankini.
My eraser's well-worn because I make a lot of mistakes.
Which is not just one thing. Like if there's actually a keyboard or a different pace or some kind of like tempo, then people's like, man, this ain't Kiss, man.
Gotta have a driving beat, you know, play just a step behind, crank the guitars. Yeah, that's all you need.
My eraser's well-worn because I make a lot of mistakes.
When you have a song that's not exactly the same tempo as when you're chewing chips, it can throw you off.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right.
For an album, I think this album has a lot of variety as far as styles on it for a Kiss album.
Definitely. Yeah. I mean, it fucking opens up with slide guitar for crying out loud.
That's what I'm saying, man. That was progressive.
Before you could walk up to your turntable, let the needle lay in that groove for a little bit there. We're going to talk about the tour. Spoiler alert, this might be my favorite. This is definitely my favorite non-makeup tour.
Okay, it's not famous for a lot of other things, but tonight is the very first night of Kiss's Hot in the Shade tour. That describes the big Sphinx behind me. No, we're not in Egypt. We're in Lubbock, Texas, of course. And tonight we're going to be seeing part of Kiss playing live. We're going to be speaking to Kiss, kind of be honest with you. I mean, I'm sitting here on Kiss's stage right now. I mean, forever, obviously, everybody was like a big Kiss fan, and I'm sitting here on Kiss's stage. It must be the Headbangers Ball. I'm Ricky Rackman. Welcome back to the Headbangers Ball. I'm here with Bruce, Gene, and Paul from, of course, Kiss. We're in Lubbock, Texas. And this is your first show of the tour, right?
Yeah, we're about to start, in fact, in a couple of hours. That's right.
I love that voice.
I love that.
That's the voice of sincerity.
That's the voice of, we're going to kick your butt.
Are you getting excited?
We're gonna have a lot of fun. Oh, yeah, we're having, look at this stage.
People can't see it, this is not a giant chimpanzee. This is a sphinx. Its name is Leon. It talks. It has lasers coming out of its mouth. It's going to even tell you that coming up, there's Faith No More, Aerosmith, Cinderella.
Why don't we break, in fact, and let's see one of ours.
From the set list to the stage, and just kind of almost like a rebirth for these guys. Did you get a chance to see this one?
Just blow through the set list, because this is one that I missed and was so pissed off that I did miss it. So,
well, okay, before I run down it, I'll tell you Betrayed was played two times and Little Caesar was played once. And Under the Gun was hung in there for a little bit, but eventually got replaced by I Was Made for Loving You. I'm pretty sure I saw Under the Gun the first time I saw him. I Was Made for Loving You, but honestly, it was so long ago, I'd have to look up the specific shows to confirm that. But here's the set list. The for the most part, this is what people saw. Love, they opened up with I Stole Your Love. Blew me away. They hadn't played that song in a long time, and man, just seeing Paul with a Les Paul walk out and go,
and And for you, if you internet kids, you know, you didn't know what the fuck the band was going to play back in the day.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
You could not find
And some of us can still just not look and show up. But I like how you say internet kids because it's just you. What am I going to see tonight? Let me hammer through this. I Stole Your Love,
please.
Deuce, Heaven's on Fire, Crazy Nights, Black Diamond, Shout It Out Loud, Strutter, Calling Dr. Love, I Was Made for Loving You, Rise to It, Fits Like a Glove, Hide Your Heart, Lick It Up, God of Thunder, Forever, Cold Gin, Tears Are Falling, I Love It Loud, Love Gun, Detroit Rock City, I Want You, and it closed out with, of course, Rock and Roll All Night. And this is like also they didn't play, or Gene didn't blow fire on this tour. And the logo was not prominent for the entire show, which was kind of a change for Kiss.
But then there is that part where the Sphinx falls apart.
Right, but that's at the end, you know, or, you know.
Then it rises from the ashes or whatever like that. I thought that was a cool effect. I do, and if, correct me if I'm wrong, but from what I've seen, I love the set list. I do think it's odd that they do Black Diamond without the big breakdown part, and it's way up in the set. That was unique. It just didn't work for me overall.
Yeah, I would slide that down, but whatever. I mean, there's so much.
Yeah.
I mean, they hit so much of their deep catalog.
Plus,
they hit, you know, the two-hour mark when they were doing basically 85-minute, 90-minute shows for the last, you know, three or four tours up to this. I mean, bringing out God of Thunder for the first time, and, I mean, since the early 80s.
Which is super odd that he didn't. This is the time that he chose not to breathe fire.
Yeah,
I mean, I know it's usually this, but he did the spit. He didn't do spitting blood either, yeah, ever during the 80s, right?
No, never did the spitting blood, but he did. He kept blowing fire.
I'm saying that would have been a song they could.
Right.
Anyway, it's just odd that they took that effect away. But anything you want to talk about from the production? From the I guess it was one of the first times they dropped. You wanted the best, you got the best. I don't think they did that in Revenge either.
But
they just came out to the drone and then they walked out to the lasers, right?
I'll tell you that because I love taking cheap shots at Paul over their set list mantra nowadays. This is a fairly deep set list with a lot of songs that your casual fan wouldn't know, and I went with at least six people that were at best casual fans. They knew Forever. They were there for Forever, but they may have known, like, Lick It Up and Heaven's on Fire, but they weren't deep. And Rock and Roll Night, of course.
Right.
They fucking the both shows I went to were damn near capacity, if not sold out. And the crowd at all of them loved it. And it wasn't because Winger and Faster Pussycat and were opening. And Slaughter, I think, did the whole tour as the first. This was like their first real thing going out there. Some of the other opening acts were Little Caesar and Vixen. I didn't really think about it too much until you mentioned it, but this did start late. Now, their first date was March 11th, but they really only did three shows between March and April. The tour really fired up May 4th. So that's what...
But the album came out, we should say the album again to revisit it.
Yeah, October,
like October
something, but...
Previous, yeah. Weird.
So what's that, 6-7 months?
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
I mean, that was the whole thing of you have a tour to support the album. So I just found it was odd that they didn't do a fall tour.
Find anything that explained why, what that was.
Right.
Paul got into a car accident and none of the bandmates called him, by the way, but that was in the middle of the tour.
We had to cancel the next few shows, yet nobody from the band called me. When I returned to the tour, I woke up every day unable to turn my head or bend down. I still had such bad back spasms that I had to have a physical therapist loosen me up before each show. Even so, nobody from the band ever asked what had happened. Nobody ever asked how I was feeling. Nobody ever mentioned it at all. I was in a car crash, for God's sakes. You're my bandmates.
They had to postpone three shows because of that. Now, one thing that I did find was funny. Hold on, let me pull this up here. On August 26th, they were performing at some city called Salina, Kansas. So that's got to be the size of Rochester, you know. And this was a fucking giant show, right? Anyway, they blew out the power supply outside the building. The transformer blew up. Paul went on a radio show shortly after and promised to return to Salina to make up for the shortened show. They played it on air. Despite that, Kiss has never been back to Salina.
So you're telling me that lost city is still lost?
Yeah, it must be. And they did a co-headlining show with White Snake at some event up in Toronto, and apparently David Coverdale was a little bitch and wouldn't let Kiss use their full stage. And according to reports, after Kiss played, quite a bit of the people left, and Whitesnake didn't have a full crowd, which I want to just believe it's true. I don't care. Fuck Whitesnake.
Yeah,
corporate
yeah.
rock.
Well, this is when the rumors are, too, that they tried to get together with Ace again, or there are some kind of efforts of it.
He was offered the opening slot, and he turned it down.
Okay. But also maybe a reunion. There's just rumors that there's maybe efforts of trying to reunite and things like that. Who knows?
Yeah, I think it's somewhat established that they were starting to have conversations about it. I don't think anything got any close to official, but they were going to do it with Eric on drums.
Correct.
And but then Eric got sick, and they just, you know, the rest is kind of what it was because of that, which is too bad, man. If you could have cleaned Ace up in 89, because, you know, I saw Ace and, you know, a bunch of times between like 92 and 95 before the reunion tour, and as fucking drunk as he might show up, he fucking killed it. And I thought he was great on that first tour with on the reunion. So, yeah, just seeing him play with Eric Carr might have been a lot of fun. But
kind of where I was going with that, too, was the fact that one of the reasons they started digging deep, like you're talking about, is they weren't trying to hammer those 80s album tracks down people's throats anymore. They finally said, okay, we're going to harken back to our roots finally, and they were kind of embracing that, versus they were kind of stepping away from that a lot, for the most part, for their 80s set lists. And they added, you know, they went from like a 90-minute show to 2 hours. So I just think that the thing that's Hot in the Shade period is great, is it was kind of like that made them go to Bob Ezrin too and do the whole Bill and Ted and we're getting beyond Hot in the Shade, but I'm saying this is just a great period, I think, for them, of just embracing more of their past.
Yeah, it seemed like it. And yeah, I think they still played the same 80s tracks, though. I mean, they really didn't drop anything. They just added a bunch of old tunes. They also looked a lot cooler than they had in a while. The Crazy Nights was kind of a step in the right direction, but that was an abysmal tour. And obviously Asylum was the peak of God for them guys. Gaudiness is what I mean, not God. But yeah, they back to the leather pants and just kind of keeping it streamlined. Gene had that cool bass with the makeup design on it. Although I think he had that on Crazy Nights too. But
yeah, they're just wearing like sneakers and stuff like that. They zipped around a lot. You know, a lot of energy and shit like that. And yeah, man. So
body glove cut at the midriff t-shirt.
was body glove in this? Or that
no,
was
I'm
Crazy
going
Nights.
Back to Crazy Nights. Now, like I said, Crazy Nights was kind of a step in the right direction. But
there's no sleeves. I mean, Paul Stanley's never been a fan of sleeves, but he went from jerseys to vests between that transition.
Exactly. Yeah. He had the paisley vest. Paul rocked pretty much most of this tour, I believe. I wonder how many he had. Like, you just see his wardrobe rolling case open up. It's this fucking paisley vest. He was really inspired by the Traveling Wilburys.
There you go,
man. Like, you know what? That could work for me. Just lose the shirt. Any more thoughts on the tour?
No. It's one that I definitely go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, a lot of people think the Sphinx is stupid. I thought it was cool as hell. Even that dumb, like, motorized mouth opening singing the middle part of God of Thunder.
Oh, flapping that. No, listen, I'm a big sucker for props, be it like Iron Maiden sets. I like sets with depth, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
That kind of thing. And also, it's almost like, I kind of joke around with this, but I think that they came up with that set design just to validate why the fuck they put a Sphinx on the cover.
Well, that's what Larry Mazur came in at that time, and he was very instrumental in, like, we should put the Sphinx on the stage. We should do a big set, that kind of deal.
It's excellent. That's why I like that and the Revenge set a lot, just because there's a lot of stuff in the background. But a fan! The only thing I was pissed off about is the Sphinx didn't give me a finger at the end when it blew up. That's for you, Craig Smith.
Yeah. You motherfucker. 1, 2, 3.
what happened. Johnny told him Rosa on a rooftop in the night. His top stood still. He couldn't hear him coming till he had them both inside. He could feel a chill. God rang out like thunder and the blood was on her head. When nothing was, when someone else had died and love was burning on the stairs.
Dead.
The slap in the face.
But going forward, it's substituting love for dick. No, let me think. Rock's not dead, but...
It'll be around forever.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.